You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions. Welcome to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 153. This is Chris Webster, and if you're hearing my voice, that means we don't have a guest today, but as we've done for a lot of episodes in the past now when I come on, we are going to deconstruct a panel, and this is a really complex, interesting panel from Portuguese Bench, and we'll talk about where that is, what's going on, and we'll do the setup, but right now, go down to your show notes if you can, unless you're driving or something like that, do it later, but the images will be in the show notes. If you're listening on Apple or Spotify, there will be a link to go to the show notes on the Archaeology Podcast Network website. It's Rock Art episode 153, and then you can find the images there. So go check them out later, or if you can, follow along with us as we deconstruct this panel. So, Alan, how's it going?
Good. It's going very well. This is episode what?
153.
Can you imagine? 153. Right. Been doing this for 6 years now.
Yeah, so exactly.
It's quite a blessing. The image I'm going to talk about, I want to talk about it in a broader sense also. One of the things I don't think we've ever talked about in our archaeology podcast, Rock Art Podcast, is how to research rock art, but integrate it into an anthropological and archaeological nexus, context, interdisciplinary fashion, bringing in the physical archaeology, the cultural sequence, the archaeofauna, the paleobotanical materials, settlement subsistence, socio-political organization, all of that and much, much more. Mm. And this particular panel is a very good one to do all of that and much more. How's that?
Well, that's perfect. Let's start by talking about where it is. And if you know anything about the time frame of it, you know, if anything on it's been dated or relatively dated. So let's talk about where and when this panel is.
So this is at a site called Portuguese Bench. It's on the eastern skirt of the far southern Sierra Nevada. It's just north of Little Lake. So it's just outside of the Coso volcanic field. And it's physically at an archaeological site that was excavated. They found burials. They found quite a voluminous amount of flake stone obsidian. It's not far from the Coso obsidian quarry, which you've probably heard over the years about, but it's one of the larger quarries in California, and it participated in a rather extensive Trans-Sierran obsidian exchange system that brought that volcanic glass from Eastern California all the way over to the Channel Islands, where they have a radiocarbon date associated with a piece of Coso obsidian going back about 10,000 years.
Wow.
So there's that. Now, what's interesting about this panel, think about this. The site was excavated years and years ago, and they have a couple of master's theses relating to the site, one relating to the flake stone and obsidian that was discovered and dating it, and another relating to the archaeobotanical and archaeofaunal remains. So that's helpful. But interestingly enough, nobody mentioned the rock art. I knew there was a rock art panel there. I'd heard about it, you know, through the ether, but had never seen it. So when the Archaeological Conservancy had an interest in acquiring a little piece of rock art of Coso that was near Little Lake, and they were out there and I was talking to them, and they said, well, you're right here. Why don't we take a quick trip and go to Portuguese Bench because we own it. So they own it and protect the archaeological site, but they've never done or really recognized any significance to the rock art.
Yeah.
It was just the site itself. So I went there, got there. It wasn't difficult to find or because it's right off of a dirt road. It's on a private ranch. So it was privately owned. That's how they were able to acquire it. And they've retained the ranch manager to watch out and make sure that nothing happens to the archaeological site or the rock art. So I went over and saw this rock art, and I was just dumbfounded, gobsmacked. I don't know what to call it. Here's this enormous rock that's jutting out of the ground like a panel. It looks like a canvas an enormous canvas of a painting. It's not basalt, it's granite, and it juts out, and covering that panel is just a unbelievable array of naturalistic, realistic imagery that is in many ways very familiar to me, but also very exotic. So on that panel at the very top is a rather small figure. The figure is holding in its left hand a snake, and the snake has that diamond-shaped head, so it's a rattlesnake. In the other hand, right, it has a baton or a wand, and instead of a face, it has a star, a four-pointed star.
That's crazy. Yeah.
So I've seen hundreds, thousands of individual elements of Koso rock art, probably more like tens of thousands. And guess what? I've never seen an image that has a star for a face like that.
Yeah, that's pretty unique.
Yeah. So if I'm reading this panel and deconstructing it, the first thing I would say is a star face, given it's probably some sort of a supra mundane being, meaning a shamanistic ancestor deity, if I wanted to use that kind of talking. This is a being that's associated with or managing the night. It's a night-related being. So the major sort of celestial body that's associated with the night, that's in the cosmology of the ancient Udo-Aztecans, is what, Doctor?
Stars.
And?
Supernova? Or what more specifically? Like the Milky Way? I don't know.
You're thinking too hard.
It might
be. What's the thing that lights up the night?
Oh, well, the moon, probably, or,
so there,
you know.
Yes, there's the moon. So
yeah, okay.
So I would say likely that this is some sort of a lunar being.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting about this being as well is I can tell you what gender she is. Oh, I skipped. See, I said she. So the anatomical detail there in her genitalia, that's it's sometimes called a pendant labia. We have other names for it. But that's very characteristic. You see it in rock art all over the world, but that's a female. Now, also, I've learned from sort of an in-depth tour of ancient and archaic Uto-Aztecan cosmology that when you see a rattlesnake like that, especially with this curvaceous, almost S-shaped image, the native people and the folks that were Aztec or Nahua and others believe that sort of image related to the rain, bringing the rain.
Oh, okay.
So we had a rainbringer female who holds the night sky, who's probably associated with the moon. Now, that other baton there, that wand in her hand, when you see these kind of wands, the shamans had a special, just a stick. It was called some sort of a wand of power. And it was sort of the heraldry, the prestigious item to have, because that was one way to wield the power of the celestial sphere, of the deities, etc. Now, a lot of the cosmological nexus for a lot of the ancient or archaic Udo-Aztecan material can be found in a deep study of the Hopi or the Nahua / Aztecs and even the Huichol. And the reason you go to those particular cultures is because they have an indigenous cosmology which they have retained for hundreds, if not thousands of years. It's preserved. So when you go to look at the analogous visual material, be it paintings, rock art, what else? Amongst the Hopi, there's special elements that they represent their gods and goddesses, and they have associated ceremonies and mm-hmm. rituals. So with that, when a colleague of mine asked a Hopi elder who happened to represent the All clan, now the All are the mm-hmm. ones that are the ones that are part of the, they have a special section, a ceremonial section, where they're part of the people that are called sun watchers.
Okay.
So their job is to track the movements of the sun and know when it's going to stop in the heavens and turn mm-hmm. around in its path and go back. So that's winter solstice sunrise or winter solstice sunset. They have a baton like that, that they said represents this, how do you put it, this medium, this movement, this trajectory, and it mm-hmm. balances the world. So much of what okay. indigenous cosmology is about, they talk about the opposites and mm-hmm. reciprocity and connecting to the animal world, the plant world, water, the sky, etc., and bringing them into balance. So it's mm-hmm. about balance. Okay.
Okay. All right. Well, you know what? I think that is probably a good point to take a break here, because we could spend on this one panel.
I just talked about one item. That's great.
I know. It's phenomenal. Yeah. So there's a lot more to get to. We'll hit some of the highlights and we'll continue this discussion on the other side. Back in a minute. Welcome back to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 153. This is Chris Webster. I'm here with Dr. Alan Garfinkel, and we are talking about this panel at Portuguese Bench in California. And I got to say, you know, we just spent the whole first segment talking about the figure at the top of the panel there, but I'm noticing down on the lower right-hand side, there's another figure with an interesting head as well, with what initially looks like a cross, which I can't imagine it is a cross unless that figure is only 150 years old or so, and, you know, they had some sort of Christian influence. But I'm guessing it's more of a plus sign, or, you know, maybe a cross figure, but that's not exclusive to Christianity. So
it is a cross, and it's not Christianity. As you're well aware, I think we had an episode about this, but there is a symbol, a particular element that is certainly cross-cultural, but especially mm-hmm. known for amongst Namek, the Great Basin, Paiute, Shoshone, the Udo Aztecans, the Nahua, the Hopi. And what's that right. called? It's an encircled cross. And an encircled cross, what that relates to is, again, the balance, bringing in harmoniously and powerfully the cardinal directions, the different essences of life, and their mm-hmm. polar opposites, and the center represents the creator, the top okay. god. Yeah. So that's probably some of what you're looking at down there.
Yeah. Okay.
This panel is interesting because it's so cosmic. I've never seen a panel that is so ethereal or cosmic. It is peppered with stars. If you look closely, there's stars all over this panel. Plus, it's peppered with images of projectile points. Mm. And what do we know about this? Well, we know about, since this is in the Koso tradition, that projectile points were imaged on rocks only during one period of time. And that's during the Newberry period from about 2000 BC to about AD 500. And so it's highly likely that this particular image relates to the religious fervor, or the hunting religion, or the cosmic consciousness of the people during that time span. There was a lot going on during that time span.
Yeah, and we've seen before that one projectile point that's kind of in the center with the lightning radiating out from it. Looks like lightning. That's a power symbol. Yeah, because we've seen this before.
And again, we can go into this parallel regarding mm-hmm. reproductive symbolism and the notion of hunting as being analogous to the birthing of a child by a woman. The men come mm-hmm. home and bring home the bacon for the family. Also, that when the points pierce the earth, it's almost like it's a particular, you know, almost a an energetic phenomenon regarding coitus. And they even have a, in the back of it, it's called, you know, that lightning rod effect, where the lightning is actually some sort of a propeller for the projectile points and the stakes for that matter.
Yeah.
And that lightning is, of course, again, some sort of a primordial being. And it's the one that allows the snakes to bring the rain. Why do the snakes bring the rain? Snakes bring the rain because, as you taught me, I didn't realize that until we had this huge conversation online in one of the podcasts, that when it rains, the snakes come out.
Yeah, they do indeed.
Please tell them the story.
Well, I mean, it was at China Lake doing survey out there, and you know, it's just big expanses of, you know, flat playa like ground and with nothing on it. And occasionally you might see a snake, but I'll tell you what, after a solid rain, and if we were out there when it rained, we'd usually get back into our vehicles because it's not safe to be out there when it's raining anyway with lightning and things like that. So we get back in the vehicles and kind of wait it out. And then we come out pretty much immediately after it's done raining, and the desert just sort of soaks up all the rain. But the water fills in all the nooks and crannies in the desert. And guess what's sitting in some of those nooks and crannies? Snakes. And they don't really like the rain either. They don't like being soaked in water and, well, not flooded with water. So they're coming out. And not only are they coming out for that reason, but some of the people we talked to said, well, they're also coming out because everything else is coming out when it rains. You know, flowers bloom and, you know, things get greener, even just for a temporary period of time, because the rain is revitalizing. So everything sort of comes out to play when it rains. But yeah, snakes and ground, I guess, dwelling animals that are just getting, they're just getting flooded out basically by that flash flooding type rain. So
since native people saw that, they associated that the serpents are bringing the rain. Rattlesnakes bring the rain.
Yeah.
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 And they're a revitalistic or sort of an eternal animal because, of course, they lose their skin and keep living. And they keep regrowing that skin. So that was viewed in the same way. And then also they saw that the human beings were purportedly sort of enervated or instigated, propelled by snakes in their bodies, because when they opened up a human body, it had veins, it had arteries, it had intestines. These are all very akin to snakes. So there's a lot of power in this whole snake metaphor. Okay.
Yeah.
So you got the points, you got the snake, but we also got all kinds of stuff going on here.
Well, yeah. I mean, is it intended to be kind of snake-like with this huge figure that's down in the lower center that looks like a person almost, but it almost looks like a person from the inside out?
Right. And I did finally recognize that. No, that's a very prescient comment, Chris, because I've looked at the inventory of decorated and solid-bodied animal humans for many years, and I finally had an aha moment that part of the story of the way they're decorating and actually embellishing the torsos is they are imprinting either snakes themselves or the design elements that occur on the snakes. So what I'm saying is there's two major snakes that appear in some of the oral history and the oral traditions, the mythology of, for instance, the Kwaisu, who are the contemporary native people there in the Kosos. And they say that they were the people, they were the animal persons that protected the underworld. And they were there for the animal master, which we've mentioned often. But the two snakes are, one is the rattlesnake, and one is the gopher snake. And if you look at both of them, one has the diamonds or triangles, and the other one has almost a circle or square-like pattern. And when you look inside of these particular beings, these powerful, supramundane spirit beings, they almost always have that kind of design element taken from the snakes.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, and this figure, it appears to be holding in its left hand, so on the right side of the image, clearly what looks like a snake. Actually, when I first glanced at it, I thought it was like a bow, you know, for like a bow and arrow, but it's clearly a snake. It's even got like the forked tongue coming out, but it almost is in the shape of a bow. And then in its right hand on the left side of the image, I'm not sure if that's supposed to, is that another snake or is it intended to be like a flower or almost look, if you want to really look at it, like a geyser, a little spring?
Well, believe it or not, that's a snake. And the other one that got on the other side is a snake. But what you're looking at head on is the visual shorthand for the bighorn sheep. One of those head on things. There's only a couple sheep in here. There's a Koso style one off to the right. And I know there's a couple of other ones off above that. So this is this particular panel is unusual because it's not dominated by that indexical animal, the highly revered bighorn sheep. So it's different. It's a different panel. Yeah. Now, that huge being, that animal that's below that apex figure, that's a mountain lion.
Oh,
because I know that because of the length of a tail. When they show the tails being that long, they're almost always mountain lions. And mountain lions are usually sort of the guardians of the entrances to holy ground. And when you go into Little Pet, if you go out to the very tip top of it where it sunlights on the valley floor, there's a huge mountain lion depicted there.
Interesting. Okay. Well, why don't we go ahead and take our final break, and then I want to talk about the sort of big figure in the middle there with the little figure inside of its stomach. That's what it looks like. So
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll talk about that on the other side back in a minute. Welcome back to episode 153 of the Rock Art Podcast. We're talking about this panel from Portuguese Bench. Again, go to your show notes if you can right now and look for the link to the APN page where this panel is. If you know where the Archaeology Podcast Network page is, you can just click on the Rock Art Podcast, and it's episode 153. So
let me jump in and remind people. One of the things this panel's all about, and it's rather obvious, but the prompt possibly not to those that are, you know, new to this kind of deconstruction of rock drawings, especially in the Kosos. It's about reproductive symbolism. It's about fertility. And there's a foot in the very center of the panel. You see that?
Yeah.
And that's something that appears in the American Southwest. It's also in the Bible, that this image of a foot has to do with, you know, reproduction, coitus, et cetera, et cetera. So, but looking at that other piece that you were concerned with, we've got either another mountain lion or series of mountain lions or wolves, I don't know which, is there right under that larger figure. But inside of that figure, it's a little tiny man or woman. There's no female genitalia, so maybe it's a man. And the man has his hands up in the air towards the sky. And I always call that an adorant posture relating to the, you know, bringing the creator down to us and bringing the conventional up to the celestial. So there's that one. And I even think that posture might be done by that little figure in the center. Like down below, you see him, like a little square guy? Yeah.
I see it.
Yeah. And another one is another one right over there, too, that has that same posture. I didn't even notice this. You're helping me here. Like a third one. They're all doing this praise. Yeah, they're all doing praise. One, two, three. Praising this. Yep. That's amazing. Wow. I never noticed that before. Wow. Well, thanks for the info. And what's interesting about it contextually is the archaeologists have dated the Portuguese Bench site using source-specific temperature-adjusted obsidian hydration dating. And the package, the most I think 80-90% of the obsidian hydration rims, and I quoted this in my PhD dissertation because I used it as a way to talk about the subsistence settlement systems and what have you. It's Newbury, but it's in the smack dab in the center of the Newbury period. Let's say, I don't know, maybe 1000 BC to AD 500, somewhere in that ballpark. And that's when things were happening. We talk about context. That was sort of the peak period of export of obsidian bifaces over towards the coast. They were doing a very brisk trade. They've demonstrated that, saying that there was almost 50 times the volume necessary for personal consumption. And they were moving those obsidian rough outs, those obsidian preforms, to the west, up above the top of the Sierras and down into the Central Valley and over to the Coast Range and off to the Channel Islands. So they call that the Obsidian Trail or obsidian highway.
Okay. I'm just wondering, because there's two images that we have. We've got the drawing, which you do a lot of analytics. You do a lot of altering of photographs, some yes. using a program called D-Stretch, and others just like different exposures and things to bring out these images. And then you have the photograph, which it looks like it's also been had some exposure stuff done to it. But you got the photograph of the actual panel. And I'll tell you what, you can tell by just immediately looking at this that these were not constructed at these images were not put on here at the same time, because right. some of them are more eroded, or not eroded really, but there's more of a patina on them, you know, stuff like
that. And there's some things that are superimposed over others.
Sure.
Et cetera. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
but this,
which is really interesting.
Yes, absolutely. And what's interesting to me about this one, and I've seen, you know, quite a number of panels from Koso Land, it's relatively unfettered in the sense that it's not such a mishmash that we can't sort of figure out the communication or the style or the message mm-hmm. that's being portrayed. You've seen a lot of those things like A Little Pet where they're just so covered with imageries and the superimposed and underlaid and et cetera, that it makes it, you know, gives you a headache trying to kind of wrap your mind about what you're seeing.
It also really makes me want to know and try to understand, which I don't know if we ever really can, but, you know, there's the imagery itself, right? There's the thing somebody is etching into this rock and they're doing it for a purpose. How much of that purpose is them etching something in that's intermingling with things that are already there, right? How much of it is individual? I just want to find an open space here and put my own thing, and it has nothing in relation to anything else. And how much of it is I'm adding to this tapestry? Right. I'm adding to this completed thing.
So I have a kind of a, you know, an interesting sidebar that sort of helps to explain some of this. Mm-hmm. I took a expert on rock art dating who's been publishing their work all over the world. And we published an article together about dating Koso rock art using portable XRF.
Okay.
We went to Little Lake, right? And he couldn't find a panel. He couldn't find an element that hadn't been repecked, you know, refreshened much later and pecked out. It was very difficult for him to find some classic, unfettered, unsort of, you know, inhibited to get his dates. So people were there for so long and so much activity that it was often, as you would say, you know, there's a lot of addition. And recharging those images to bring back the power and the influence and the magic, the connection to the supernatural beings that live in the highest heights and the heavens. And that's what this is about. And you can kind of get a sense of that. It's sort of layered, you know, in terms of the way this is depicted. It almost has like a sort of a standard sense of looking at it and viewing it as a unit, doesn't it? It almost seems like it's trying to tell you something. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting. I've often wondered that about rock art too, because like you said, sometimes you can see images that are literally over the top of other ones. And, you know, that gives you an idea of depth of time, really, not only just depth in the rock art, but yeah, something as complex as this, I just wonder, you know, people coming by just to leave their mark and leave their influence on this.
Yeah.
And how do they reinterpret the image, or how does the next person come along and reinterpret this panel after something's been added? You know what I mean? Does something get added, change its meaning?
So the artisans that did this, at least if you go by the conventional theory that's been, you know, pounded in the ground for X amount of years, is if we assume that the ritual adepts or the shamans are principally the authors of these images, right? The message that was invoked, the part of the cultural tapestry to the native people, is these are powerful. These are his way of bringing out the nature of our stories, our sacred narratives, what we know about the universe. And you're not supposed to touch them. If you touch them, right, you'll go blind. You're not supposed to touch them. You can view it, but certainly don't mess with it because it's too powerful and this other arena is only the arena of those that understand and have the skill and the knowledge and the training to profess these kinds of images. Wow. And that's in the literature. And it's also from what I heard direct. It's in the movie that I did on the documentary film on Talking Stone. Yeah.
Talking Stone, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Interesting. All right. Well, a few minutes left in this podcast. What other elements do you want to bring out and discuss right here in the last bit?
I just want to say that it's important to understand when you know the temporal fix on this, what was going on in the Cosos. This was the heyday. This was the peak period of religiosity, hunting religion. And we know that in some ways because of other dated shrines or dated elements of the rock art record. Mm-hmm. They've been able to date them and look at the nature. The economy was going grand. It was the peak period of when they're exporting all of these obsidian bifaces. They also were now being able to live in a semi-permanent way along the fringe of the Sierra Nevadas. We find at Rose Spring, which is not very far away from this on the other side of the highway, they're connected with the fringe of the Coso Range, was that corn sheep cranium shrine that sat on this long plinth, this long, tall, oblong rock that was dated twice to AD 500. And at the base of that, there was an offering of a humbled basal notch biface in a beautiful way. It wasn't used. It was a perfectly, you know, manicured production left there at that shrine. And the humbled basal notch bifaces, I spent a year or two studying, and they date precisely between 500 BC and AD 800. So that 500 AD 500 is right about the interface between the end of the Newberry, beginning of the Heiwi. And the Heiwi sort of begins to diminish the popularity of the bighorn. It sort of changes the religiosity from being a feminine-centered to more androcentric male expression. That's where you begin to see all those pictures of the men hunting the bighorn with their otlottles, or the men hunting the bighorn with their bows and arrows. And these feminine beings that were so popular before are there, they're recharged, but they're not produced probably anymore as a grand element to what's available in the Coso canon, the Coso assemblage. So it's, and you can see that, but you can only wrap your mind around it if you really understand what the nature of the characteristics and context of the archaeological record and how that interfingers with the rock art. All right.
Interesting. Yeah, there's a lot here. And I encourage the listeners to go, again, take a look at this and take a look at the original with the photograph anyway. That's, again, slightly doctored to bring out some elements. And then take a look at the drawing. And one final note on drawings as well. I mean, there's some really skilled people out there that can recreate these images in a drawing. But I also feel like, you know, so I've done drawings before of rock art and of, you know, profile walls and things like that in archaeology. And I'll tell you what, it's hard not to put a little bit of bias in there, put a little spin and put a little, not like you're changing anything, but the way that you're representing something that, you know, you might darken this line a little more than it probably should have. You know, you might do this, you might do that. And it could get some influence on the drawing itself. But otherwise, yeah, this is an impressive piece of work here, especially given the original. So, wow. Okay. Well, I think with that, then we'll probably call it here. And I know we've got some guests lined up coming up here in the future. Our producer, Ash, is doing a fantastic job. And she's even got us lined up for a guest lined up for October of next year. Wow. So,
God bless us.
I know, right? So we're going to keep this going for a long time. So, all right. Well, Alan, thanks a lot for this analysis.
Chris, it's always a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.